Imagine the clang of hammers on steel, the hiss of steam rising from the docks, the air thick with coal dust and ambition. That was Belfast in 1898, a city of iron, linen, and contradiction. The city's skyline rose with the pride of an empire. There was electric trams gliding past Victorian grandeur and smoke-belching factories. It was modern, loud, and growing, and it was into this world on November 29th, 1898, that Clive Staple Lewis was born. His father, Albert, was a lawyer, a man of words and logic. His mother, Florence, was a mathematician, brilliant and warm. His grandfather, a preacher. The threads of intellect, faith, and imagination were already being woven into the boy's life. Clive had an older brother, Warren. He called Warnie, and from the very start, the two were inseparable. They didn't just play, they created imaginary kingdoms, talking animals, worlds that stretched out in stories and scraps of paper. But there was something else too, something peculiar for a child so young. Clive hated his own name. At just 4 years old, tragedy struck. The family dog was killed in an accident. It devastated little Clive. And from that day forward, Clive insisted on being called by the dog's name, Jack. Jack Lewis, and that's who he would be for the rest of his life. The boy who renamed himself, the boy who built worlds from stories, the boy who one day would become a titan of imagination, philosophy, and faith. This is the story of C.S. Lewis. I'm Laura Lee Siemens, and this is the Church History Podcast. Welcome back to the Church History Podcast. If you're just joining us, this season is called The Church at War, a journey through the early 1900s as we explore how the global church responded to the outbreak of war, both on the battlefield and in the hearts of believers. We move through church history chronologically. We unfold the story of God's people from the book of Acts all the way to our modern era. And today, we're focusing on one man, a man whose mind shaped theology, literature, and imagination for generations to come. A man whose life was shaped again and again by trauma. Today, we're stepping into the world of C.S. Lewis. But before we do that, many of you have asked, how can I support this podcast? Well, one of the best ways is through my books. I write about church history in a way that's accessible, personable, and true to the incredible stories of faith that have shaped our world. Whether you're a longtime listener or new to the journey, the books are a great companion to everything we talk about here. Here's a quick word about that. My new book, The Church is Corrupt, is available for order. I previously published the book, The Church is Born, which was part one in our series, and that delved into the creation of the church. But my second book picks up where the first one left off. It offers a unique and insightful perspective on the church's journey. Discover the rich history of the church, its triumphs, its failures, and its heroes. In this second book in the series on church history, we journey through the pivotal moments that shaped Christianity as we know it. From the foundational theology of the early church to the inspiring lives of great men and women who boldly stood for their faith. Explore the church's role during the Crusades, the Inquisitions, and even the discovery of America. Learn how over centuries, the church began to slowly lose its way, setting the stage for the monumental changes just before the Protestant Reformation. With each chapter highlighting a different story, you're going to be inspired by the heroes of our faith and challenged to reflect on the lessons from the church's successes and its stumbles. Whether you're a seasoned historian or just beginning your exploration of church history, this book offers valuable insights for everyone. Both books, The Church is Born and The Church is Compromised, are available on Amazon for you to order. So if you haven't gotten the first book, why not get both today and delve into the comprehensive understanding of the church's journey? By 1905, the Lewis family had found something precious, a sanctuary, a place that would shape two young boys in a way no one could predict. They called it Little Lay. Set just in the outskirts of Belfast, Little Lay was more than a house. It was a world of its own. Albert Lewis, Jack's father, had built it for his beloved wife, Florence. Every stone and staircase whispered of love and devotion. And inside, books. Everywhere, books lined the shelves of the sitting room, filled the bedrooms, spilled into the attic. They crowded the house like forests of ideas. There was mythology, history, theology, romance, and nothing was off limits. The boys were given total freedom to explore and read it all. Jack, still just a small boy, could already read Latin, Greek, French. His mother had taught him. In fact, he was only 3 years old when he started reading. And by the time they moved to Little A, Jack wasn't just reading books, he was devouring them. But the most magical place in this little house wasn't the library. It was a little room at the end of the upstairs hall. It didn't have any grand windows or carved woodwork, but to Jack and Warren, the Warrenie as he called them, it was the gateway to other worlds. Here, the two boys invented imaginary lands. They wrote stories, drew maps of the worlds they were created. They even created languages. Jack's stories were always about animals, talking animals, brave, noble creatures who lived and fought and dreamed. And Warrenie, one day, inspired by Jack's stories, gave him a gift. It was a world in a box, just a little toy model that he had made. But when Jack looked at it, really looked at it, he felt something he didn't have a name for, a sudden piercing delight, a sense of something real, but just beyond his reach, a longing. He called this place paradise, and what he was looking for was joy. That moment stayed with him his entire life. The joy wasn't like happiness. It wasn't pleasure. It was deeper and fleeting and mysterious. But once he felt it, Jack Lewis began chasing it for the rest of his life. He called that world inside the box paradise. In 1908, the world that Jack and Warrenie had built with words and wonder came crashing down. It began quietly, with tiredness. His mother, Flora, was ill. And then they heard the word cancer. Little Leia, once a house so full of life and stories, became a house of shadows. There was hushed voices behind closed doors, a sharp scent of medicine in the halls. There was whispers and crying, and always fear. Jack had been raised with the Bible. Flora had read it to her sons faithfully. She had given each of them their own copy. And Jack believed what it said. Jesus healed the sick. Jesus even raised the dead. So Jack prayed, not as a theologian or philosopher, with utter certainty. He believed his mother would be healed. He never even feared her death. Why would he? Jesus would save her. But on August 23rd, 1908, in the middle of the night, Jack woke with a sharp pain in his jaw. He had a toothache, and he called for his mother. But she didn't come. Instead, his father came. Albert Lewis sat on the edge of his bed. In a voice that Jack would never forget, he told him his mother was gone. Jack didn't believe it. He refused to. After all, Jesus had raised people from the dead. He remembered the stories, Lazarus, Jairus' daughter, the widow's son. So Jack waited. He waited for the miracle. Jesus would clearly raise his mother from the dead. But the miracle never came. Instead, came the funeral. A grave, and with it the burial of more than just a mother. The house that had once held laughter and imagination now was silenced. The joy that danced in all the corners was gone, and in its place was grief. Jack was only 9 years old, just months away from turning 10, and the world he thought he knew, the God he thought he knew, had failed him. Grief didn't just break the Lewis home, it reshaped it. After Flora's death, Albert Lewis was not the same man. He became bitter, quick-tempered. Grief does strange things for people, and for Albert, it hardened him. The house that had once overflowed with warmth and books and stories was now filled with tension and anger. One day, Jack and Warrenie, desperate to cling to this imaginary world they had once shared, built a tent inside the house. Inside it, they made up a new world. It was their effort to bring joy back into the corners of their little home. But when Albert came home and saw the mess, he exploded. He yelled and screamed at the boys. and he threatened them and said, "I'll send you both to America." That night, Jack lay in bed with his heart pounding. The world had already taken his mother. Now he feared it would take everything else. He waited, night after night, afraid that at any moment his father would make good on the threat. But Albert didn't send them to America. Instead, he sent him to boarding school. Only 1 month after his mother's death, in September, Albert sent the boys away. Just like that, there was no more familiar bookshelves, no more imaginary lands and attic rooms, no more Warnie to whisper stories with at night. Jack was 10. He'd lost his mother to death. He'd lost his father to bitterness. And now he was losing his brother to distance. He was sent to the Warnard School, a boarding school in England. It was strict, cold, and definitely a joyless place. The headmaster was harsh and the discipline severe. This was not a school for dreamers. This was a place for obedience and rules. A place where wonder did not belong. For Jack, it felt like he was being punished. He was alone, wounded, and thinking, why had he even trusted God at all? School was supposed to shape boys into men. At Warnard, the rules were clear. A boy's worth was measured on the playing field. A boy's worth was measured by strength, speed, and athletic dominance. Jack didn't stand a chance. He had deformed thumbs, something no one had ever really talked about before. But because of that, he couldn't catch a ball properly. He couldn't hold a bat like other boys. He tried, but it didn't work. And the other boys noticed. To them, Jack was soft. He liked books. He loved stories. He preferred Latin grammar to rugby chants. And that made him different. The boys felt that he was too feminine. In 1911, Jack was transferred to a new school, part of the Malvern College in England. Now he had a new uniform, new rules, and new disappointments. The school was no kinder than the last one. But at this school, something unexpected happened. In gym class of all places, Jack encountered Beauty. One day, the door opened, and in walked a dancing teacher. She was unlike anything Jack had seen. She was confident and graceful. She smelled like powder and flowers. And utterly unaware of the storm, she had just awakened. She said something strange that Jack never forgot. She opened her mouth and said, "I love the smell of bunting." He didn't even know what that meant, but it felt like poetry and it was beautiful. At that moment, Jack suddenly realized something. Girls were beautiful, not in a storybook way, not in abstract. They were truly beautiful and mysterious. He was a tender-hearted boy, but the world around him said that wasn't enough. He needed to be a man, and he wanted girls to like him. So he believed to be a man, he had to be hard, stoic, and tough. So he buried the softness and the wonder and the joy, and he tried to be the kind of man he thought the world demanded. Time passed and Jack grew. School terms came and went, and during the holidays, Jack would return home. But home was no longer a place of comfort, not for Jack. His relationship with his father, Albert, did not recover. There was no warm welcomes, no deep conversations. There was polite exchanges and arguments. Albert tried to talk in the only way he knew how. He lectured. He gave orders. Jack didn't open his heart to the man who had sent him away. There was a wall between them now. And then came the day of Jack's first communion. It was meant to be a holy moment, a rite of passage, the bread, the wine, the mystery of grace. Jack dressed in his Sunday best. He recited the liturgy. He bowed his head and he said the words. But inside, nothing. He didn't believe it. Not any of it. Something in him had gone quiet and cold. Faith, that had once been a very important part of his childhood, was just a memory. But he didn't tell his father. He didn't tell anyone. He went through the motions. He was a boy kneeling at the altar, eyes closed, mouth open, but his soul was far away. By 1914, Jack Lewis was no longer the boy who believed with childlike faith. He was growing into a teenager now, quiet, withdrawn, deeply intellectual, and quietly disillusioned. He was longing for something more. And then he saw something. He saw how a man named William T. Kirkpatrick had sharpened his older brother Warren's mind. Kirkpatrick was known as the Great Knock, and he was a former headmaster, a rationalist, a hard thinker, not somebody known for softness. Jack believed this man might be the teacher he needed. So he went to his father with a special request. "I want to leave school behind. I want to be tutored, privately, by Dr. Kirkpatrick." Albert was surprised. He warned Jack, "If you move in with Mr. Kirkpatrick, there'll be no classmates to play with, no other schoolboys, no teams, no sports." He didn't even know. That's exactly what Jack wanted. Jack had never told him how miserable school had been, how he dreaded the sports, how he didn't fit in, how other boys mocked him. Instead, Jack just said, "I want to go." And in April of 1914, at the age of 15, Clive Staples Lewis moved into the home of William T. Kirkpatrick. Jack felt he was exactly where he needed to be. From the very first day in the William Kirkpatrick's home, Jack knew he had found his world. Kirkpatrick was an atheist, but he was also a brilliant, relentless mind. He did not believe in God, but he did believe in reason. He lived for arguments, for books, for language. He read, he wrote, he debated, and he demanded the same from Jack. The routine was strict, but beautiful. Breakfast at 8. By 9, Jack was at his desk, reading, writing, and translating Latin, Greek, and German. At 1 o'clock, lunch. The afternoon was for walking and thinking. At 4 o'clock, tea, more study, usually the classics, and supper at 7. After 7 was long evenings filled with conversation and debate. Bed strictly at 11, and then you're up to do it all over again. For most teenage boys, this would have seemed unbearable, but for Jack, it was paradise. His mind grew sharper by the day. He began reading German fluently. He pored over classical texts, and one writer above all captured his imagination, William Butler Yeats. Yeats wasn't only a poet, he was a mystic. His writings were drenched in mystery and myth and the supernatural, and Jack just couldn't get enough. He was obsessed. He had a hunger for wonder and craving for something just beyond the veil. Later in life, he would call this a spiritual lust. Jack became fascinated with mysticism. He began to read about the occult, seance circles, spirit boards, rituals designed to pierce the line between life and death, and he loved it. Not just the mystery of it, but the rebellion of it. Christians warned against it, atheists dismissed it, and Jack ran towards it because it was dangerous. He felt like everyone else was asleep, and he was the only one waking up. One of his favorite routines was to walk to a bookshop in a nearby town. He'd spend hours browsing the shelves, flipping through pages, looking for the next great book to feed his hunger. One day, in a little shop, he found a strange old volume. It was called Fantates by George MacDonald, and he bought it, boarded a train, and sat by the window and began to read. By the time he got home, something inside him had shifted. This book spoke of another world, but not the occult, not the supernatural. It was something pure, holy. Jack didn't fully understand it yet, but something in him whispered, this is what you're really looking for. Later in life, Jack would say that he had truly longed for back then, through all the rituals and all the rebellion, wasn't actually supernaturalism. What he longed for and what he needed was holiness. While Jack was studying ancient texts and debating metaphysics, the world outside his quiet routine was collapsing. In August of 1914, Britain declared war on Germany. Across the country, propaganda posters painted the Germans as monsters, devils in uniform. Patriotism surged. Young men barely out of school lined up to enlist. Jack was just 15, too young to fight, old enough to understand the world he knew was changing. In December 1916, Jack earned a scholarship to the University College, Oxford. He was thrilled. Oxford, one of the oldest universities in the world. It was everything Jack had dreamed of, and he had a scholarship. This was a place of learning, of language, of brilliance. He packed his things, said goodbye to the Kirkpatricks, and stepped into the ancient halls of Oxford. But war doesn't wait. By June of the following year, 1917, Jack had turned 18, and like most of his generation, he enlisted. He joined the British Army. Jack had never been good with boys his own age. He'd always preferred books to conversation, solitude to locker rooms. But during military training, he found something unexpected. A friend. It was really his first friend other than his brother. His name was Paddy Moore. He was 18, just like Jack, and they clicked. One night, sitting side by side on their bunks, they made a promise. If one of them didn't make it home, the other would look after his family. It was a bond, sealed by the certainty of war. Then came the front lines, and Jack entered the trenches. On his first day under fire, he heard the bullets zipping overhead, and he actually didn't panic or flinch. Instead, he thought of Homer. "This is war," he said to himself. "This is what Homer was writing about?" But this wasn't poetry. It was mud and blood and fear. It was the spring of 1917, the Battle of Arras. It was part of the coordinated Allied effort, Britain attacking near Arras, while the French struck further south. The goal was to break through German lines, shatter enemy morale, and end the dreadlock of trench warfare. The British Empire threw everything it had at the front. Tanks, machine guns, aerial units, and nearly 300,000 men. They started this on April the 9th, Easter Monday. For 7 days, British artillery pounded German positions with over 2 million shells. And when the troops finally advanced through the mud and the wire, it worked at first. The British made great gains, far more than expected. They pushed the Germans back nearly 5 miles in a single day. They captured high ground in towns like Vimy Ridge. But then everything slowed down because the rain came and the mud thickened and German reinforcements dug in. And what followed was a brutal stalemate. Men clawing for inches of shattered land, weeks of trench raids, counterattacks, suffocating gas. By the time it was over, nearly 160,000 British and Commonwealth soldiers had been killed or wounded. The mud was red. And there, in that soaked mud, was Jack. And suddenly, there was an explosion. Jack never saw it coming. Shrapnel tore through the air like knives. A piece stuck him in the chest, then the legs. He hit the ground hard, the wind knocked out of his lungs. The pain came next, hot and pulsing. And what he saw beside him would haunt him for the rest of his life. His lieutenant, his commanding officer, who had just saved his life the day before, lay sprawled in the mud. Parts of his body gone. The explosion had ripped him apart. Jack couldn't move. He couldn't speak. He lay there in the mud and thought, "I am dying. Here lies a man dying." And then the strangest thing, he thought, "This is not even interesting. There's no music. There's no poetry. No special light. There's just blood and mud. This is not what he thought death would be like." But something inside him refused to give up. Maybe it was an instinct, maybe it was grace, but something inside of him said, "Live." So Jack began to crawl. He pulled himself forward inch by inch through the mud, past the shattered bodies of his friends, to a place where the medics could find him. And somehow he made it. A stretcher team reached him, pulled him from the battlefield, and loaded him onto a medical truck. He was still bleeding, still in pain, but he was alive. Jack survived the battlefield, but the war never left him. Even after the uniform came off, even when the wound started to heal, that war stayed in his mind and in his dreams. For many years after that, Jack suffered nightmares. He would wake in the middle of the night, sweating, shaking, and gasping for air. Those images refused to leave him. The shrapnel, the broken bones, the moment he thought he was going to die, and felt nothing. During his recovery in the hospital, Jack was given a book by a writer named J.K. Chesterton. It was the first time in a long time that something stirred his soul. Chesterton wasn't just a Christian. He was brilliant. He made arguments for God that were not naive or emotional. They were logical, philosophical. They were even poetic. And Jack found himself intrigued. Now, he didn't agree with this writer, but he respected them. And it planted a question in his mind. Could intellectual people believe in God? But every time that question tried to take root, another voice would answer. A dark voice. A voice shaped by the mud and the gunfire and the dying man. If there was a God, why hadn't he stopped the war? Why had he let boys die screaming in ditches? And worse, if he did have the power to stop it, if God was real and he could have stopped the war and didn't, wasn't that even more terrifying? Jack wrote, "If there is a God, he must be a terrible, horrible God." It was December 1918. The war was over. Jack Lewis was 19 years old, discharged from the British Army, physically scarred, emotionally worn, but he was no longer a boy. He returned to Oxford. Now he was a man. He was quieter now, more deliberate. He'd seen death up close, and he'd seen madness in men's eyes. And now he was ready to live, not as a boy, but as a man. Part of that decision meant walking away from something he had once loved, the occult. Jack had really enjoyed seances and spirit boards. He had loved reading Yeats and chasing after his hidden knowledge. He had wanted the thrill of forbidden things. But something had changed. One night on the battlefield, he had seen a fellow soldier, a man who was involved in the occult. And when he had died, he had screamed. He had cried out that he was being dragged into hell. Jack didn't believe in hell. He didn't even believe in God. But that memory burned in his mind, and he felt like it was some kind of a warning, a line, do not cross here. So he simply put all of the occult books away. Not because he was a believer, but because he wasn't a believer. If he didn't believe in God, he couldn't believe in this either. Back at Oxford, one absence haunted him. His friend, Paddy Moore, his closest friend, the boy he had made a vow with. Paddy didn't come home from the war. Jack found his family just as he had promised. Paddy's father had gone, abandoned the family when Paddy was just a little boy. But his mother, Miss Janie Moore, and his sister Maureen still lived, and they were alone. So Jack did something few 19-year-olds would do. He moved in with them. He helped them with the home. He bought groceries. He ran errands. He even helped them with the rent. And Mrs. Moore became something he had been missing for years, a mother. Jack had lost his own mother at 9, and now, 10 years later, he had found another mother. And he would care for her for the rest of her life. Out of loyalty, and out of love, and out of a promise he had made, beside a bunk bed, he was 18 years old. And at Oxford, he met other young men who lived in their minds, who loved books, ideas, and languages. Together, they debated everything. They debated politics, philosophy, art, but most of all, theology. One friend in particular shared Jack's worldview. He was, like Jack, a materialist. That was someone who believed that reality was nothing more than what you could see, touch, and measure. But then one evening, that friend came with an announcement. He had changed his mind. He had become a Christian. Jack was stunned and then furious. It felt like a betrayal, like intellectual cowardice. How could a rational, thinking person abandon materialism? How could anyone go backward, back to myths and fairy tales? The arguments began and didn't stop. Night after night, the young men gathered in dorm rooms, common halls, and at the bar, their voices rising over the crackling of the fire. They debated materialism versus faith, reason versus revelation. Jack argued with passion, but slowly, deep down, he began to feel it. His position just wasn't as solid as he thought. There was another friend who also argued with him. That man, his name was J.R.R. Tolkien. Yes, that Tolkien. He also was a Christian. But unlike the dry religion that Jack had rejected, Tolkien's faith was rich and alive with imagination. And Tolkien and Jack loved to talk for hours about Norse legend, medieval texts, and the power of telling a story. Tolkien didn't argue, he invited. And Jack found himself thinking, maybe the faith he dismissed wasn't childish. Maybe that faith was stronger and older than he'd realized. He began to reread the authors he had always loved. George MacDonald, J.K. Chesterton, Dante, Milton, even Shakespeare. And he began to notice something. The writers who stirred him the most, who filled him with longing, who seemed to speak to that hidden ache in his soul, were all Christians. The writers who rejected Christianity were clever and entertaining, but when it came to truth, none of them had answers. And Jack started to ask real questions. At that same time, he wanted to be a writer. He didn't just want to be a writer. He wanted to be a great writer, the greatest writer. He believed in language. Ever since he was a child, he had shaped imaginary worlds with Warney. He had studied the masters. He had survived a war. He had searched for meaning. And he'd sharpened his mind with blades, with debate. And he was ready, or at least he thought he was. In 1919, under the pen name Clive Hamilton, he published his first book, Spirits in Bondage. It was a collection of poems. They were dark, modern, brooding. It was his answer to the war, his cry into the void. But critics ignored it, readers passed it by, and nobody was interested. So Jack tried a second book, Dymer. This was a long narrative poem. It was filled with symbolism and myth and this cosmic struggle. This one, he thought, for sure. He found his voice. Everyone will love this book. But it flopped. There was no buzz, no praise, no breakthrough. In fact, anyone who did read it said it was so long they couldn't even finish it. He had failed as a writer, and that was a deep wound. In 1925, Jack reached a new milestone. He became a fellow and tutor of English at Magdalen College, Oxford. This was a great appointment and a job he would keep for the next 30 years. He had arrived academically and professionally. He was respected and brilliant, admired by students. His lectures were packed. Really, he had the life he had dreamed of. But his heart was still empty. And then one day, he received a letter. His father, Elbert, was sick. Jack hadn't spoken to him in years. And suddenly, all those wounds from childhood, the bitterness, the distance, the silence, he realized he needed to do something. That summer, he traveled home, and he spent 6 weeks with his father. And in that time, something long broken was healed. They didn't just talk, they laughed, they walked, they remembered. And for the first time, Jack saw that his father really did love him. Albert was proud of Jack, proud of the scholar he'd become, proud of the man he'd become. By the end of the summer, they weren't just father and son, they were friends. And then Albert died, and Jack was left without parents. But in that aloneness, something unexpected happened. He realized he did believe in God. He didn't believe in Jesus, and he didn't believe in heaven, and he definitely didn't believe in the church. But he believed in God. God as a spirit. He didn't know what to call it. Maybe all religions were wrong. Maybe none of them had it fully right. But he believed in this. God, this spirit, as he called it, was real. And not just real, but personal. One day, Jack heard a voice when he was talking to this spirit. And the voice simply said, I am. And in that moment, Jack believed in the I am. He believed in God. He still wasn't a Christian. He still didn't believe in Jesus. He still didn't believe in the afterlife. He didn't even believe in hope. But in his words, he was a reluctant theist. But that belief came with a burden. If God was real, then really Jack had to do something about it. So he started attending church. He didn't like it. The sermons were boring. They didn't make him think at all. He didn't feel anything as they sang the hymns. He didn't connect with any of the people there. And he thought, if there is a God, I guess I should go where he might be. So he continued going to church week after week. Not because he wanted to be there, because he thought he should be there. Because deep down, He wanted to know this God who called himself I Am. By 1930, Jack Lewis had lived years near the university. He had been a soldier, a student, a writer, although a failed writer, and now a reluctant believer. He'd walked through grief and war and doubt. He'd argued and debated. He was tired, and he realized he needed a home, and that year he found one. It was a quiet house just outside of Oxford. It was nestled among woods and ponds. He called it the Kilns. It wasn't a grand palace. It was peaceful, and it was something he hadn't known in years. It reminded him of his childhood. It reminded him of the Little Leigh, his home in Belfast, before the grief and the war. Before this long, hard debate he'd had with doubt and religion. He moved into that home, but not alone. Of course, he brought Mrs. Moore and her daughter, still honoring the vow he made to her son on a wartime bunk. She was now his mother, and she would have a home too. But also his brother Warney moved in. Warney had retired from the army and needed rest, and Jack welcomed him. Together, they became a family. The Kilns, he filled that place with books, long walks, cozy dinners, and of course, lively debates. He made it as much like the home he had known as a child. Reading by the fire, talking about ideas, letting stories come alive. And for the first time in many, many years, Jack Lewis felt rooted. It was 1931. Jack was now 33 years old. He had spent years debating, doubting, and wrestling with God. Late night walks, tea-fueled arguments, endless conversations with J.R.R. Tolkien.
Complain? Our children love it. I will not have another
who gently but persistently pressed him to see the truth, not just to believe in God, but to believe in Christ. Jack came to believe in a God, a creator, a spirit. He called him the I Am, with the idea that Jesus of Nazareth really was the Son of God, that the myths he loved of dying and raising gods were actually shadows of something real. That he didn't believe until one morning. Jack was driving to the Whipsnade Zoo, and as he sped down the road, Jack wasn't watching the trees rush by. He was replaying conversations in his head, all of Tolkien's arguments, things he'd read in Charleston books, the gospel stories. And suddenly, he just knew. Jesus was God. Christianity was true. And he, Jack, was a sinner in need of grace. He didn't see a great light. He didn't hear a voice. But something opened, and into that space rushed something he had searched for his whole life, joy. It had found him, or perhaps it had been waiting for him all along. By the time he reached the zoo, Jack Lewis had given his life to Jesus Christ and was a Christian. Shortly after that, Jack did something simple. He took communion, but this time it wasn't just a routine, a ritual. This time, he believed. And the boy who once knelt in a church and whispered, "I don't believe any of this," now bowed his head in awe. He was no longer chasing joy. Joy had found him. By the mid-1930s, Jack wasn't just a believer. He was a man on a mission. He didn't want to preach, though. He wanted to tell stories. Because he and Tolkien believed something, that a good story could carry a truth deeper than a sermon ever could. One evening, Lewis and his friend J.R.R. Tolkien sat talking again about the books they wished existed. Books that explored time and space, not just with technology, but with theology. Books where faith and imagination weren't separated. Tolkien said, "No one's writing the stories we want to read." Jack said, "Then we will write them." So they flipped a coin. Tolkien would write a time series. Jack would write a space series. What was the result? Tolkien wrote The Lord of the Rings. And Jack wrote a strange, bold, and powerful space trilogy. It's also known as the Cosmic Trilogy. The first book, Out of the Silent Planet, came out in 1938, followed by The Voyage to Venus, and then The Hideous Strength. This book followed a man named Dr. Ransom, who traveled to Mars, Venus, and then to Earth to confront a cosmic war between good and evil. These weren't just science fiction, they were theological allegories. Jack had done something few writers had ever done. He had crafted fantasy, but not fantasy to escape into, fantasy that was an invitation, a way back to wonder, and a way back to truth. Jack knew firsthand, sometimes it takes a story to bring you home. September 1st, 1931, the world was at war again. Germany had invaded Poland. Britain responded, and in a single day, Europe stood back on the edge of destruction. World War II had begun. Jack was now a professor, an author, and a believer, and he watched it unfold with sadness. He had lived through a war already, and now he was seeing what bombs could do to cities. He knew what grief could do to faith. In 1940, just a year into the war, he published a book called The Problem of Pain. He asked one of the hardest questions in all of theology. Where is God when it hurts? When bombs fall? When children cry? When the world turns to ash? Is God still good? Jack's answer was not easy, but it was honest. Pain, he wrote, is God's megaphone to rouse a deaf world. Suffering is not a contradiction to faith. It's an invitation to trust in something beyond understanding. The book struck a nerve. And then Jack did something bolder. He wrote a book about hell, but not in the way anyone expected. In 1942, he released The Screwtape Letters. This is a story of a junior demon named Wormwood, who is tasked with leading a man into destruction. Wormwood is guided and often mocked by his uncle Screwtape, a senior demon, with centuries of experience corrupting human souls. The book is satire, but sharp. In one scene, Wormwood asks his uncle whether he should tempt the young man to support or oppose the war. And Screwtape laughs. It doesn't matter, he said, whether he's for or against it. Make him certain he's right. Then fill him with hatred for anyone who disagrees. Let him feel that his cause is holy and all others are evil. Feed his pride, fuel his contempt. And we'll have him, no matter which side he's on. Jack had seen what war did to men. He had lived through those trenches. And he saw what war could do to the soul. His message was simple. It's not what side you're on that damns you. It's what your heart becomes in the process. During World War I, Jack was a soldier in the mud, wounded, frightened, dying without hope. But in World War II, he was something else, a voice of hope. As Britain, again, found itself under siege, its cities bombed, its people scattered, the BBC turned to an unlikely figure, a professor, a former atheist, a man who knew what it was to question everything. They asked Jack to speak on the radio to address the nation. He went by his birth name, C.S. Lewis. And he would answer the questions people were too afraid to say aloud. Is there still a God? Where is he in all this fear? Does faith even matter anymore?
In these talks, I've had to say a good deal about prayer. And before going on to my main subject tonight, I'd like to deal with a difficulty some people find about the whole idea of prayer.
And so Jack spoke as C.S. Lewis. Not with fire and brimstone or with some booming oratory, he was calm and steady. He talked about sin and grace and the stubborn truth of Christianity in a broken world. His words were so simple and clear, and literally millions listened. Week after week, his broadcast became the most listened to program on the BBC. Later, those talks were published as a book and became one of the most influential books in church history, Mere Christianity. At that very same time, Britain was evacuating children. The Blitz was turning London into rubble, and families were forced to send their young sons and daughters to the countryside, anywhere to be safe. So Jack opened his home. And the Kilns welcomed four children. One day, a little girl asked a simple question. Can I play inside that wardrobe? Jack nodded and then paused. That question, so innocent, it opened something in his imagination. And he saw it, a hidden world inside of a wardrobe, a snow-covered forest, a lamppost in the woods, and a lion. That question became the beginning of a story that would change generations. In 1950, he published the first book in the series, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and it was followed by six more. They became known as the Chronicles of Narnia. These weren't just stories. They taught young readers without preaching that courage, humility, and grace could conquer even the darkest magic. At that same time, Jack's academic career reached new heights. In 1954, he was appointed to one of the most prestigious posts in the world of literature, chair of medieval Renaissance literature at Cambridge University. It was a rare honor, especially for someone who had spent so much of his career at Oxford. But Jack accepted. He moved between these two worlds, one filled with these ancient texts and university halls, the other filled with fauns and talking beavers and golden thrones, and somehow he belonged in both. Over the years, Jack received thousands of letters from fans, from skeptics, from children who had walked through wardrobes in their imagination. But one day, a letter stood out to him. It was from a woman named Joy Davidman. She was unlike anyone Jack had ever met. Joy was a Jewish writer from New York, once an atheist and a committed Marxist. But while reading Jack's books and hearing his logic and longing and language, she had been led to Christ, and they began writing letters to each other. What began as an intellectual admiration soon grew into friendship, and then something deeper. They were matched in wit, in passion, and in faith. Joy had two sons. She had lived a hard life, and she was sick. Bone cancer, the same disease that had taken Jack's mother. It felt familiar. Joy and her boys came to England. Jack, never one to rush into emotion, realized something. He cared about Joy. He loved her. He wanted to protect her and her sons, just as he had once needed protecting. But her health was collapsing. Doctors said, really, it was only a matter of days. So Jack married Joy, knowing she would die in just a few days. Jack called a close friend to come and pray for her. There were no dramatic scenes, no thunders from the heavens, but a quiet prayer over a dying woman. And then something happened. She got better. Not just better, miraculously better. Her cancer went into remission. It was, as Jack would later say, as if a door had been opened. And so for the next few years, those were the happiest of Jack's life. He had a family, a wife, two sons. They traveled, they read together, they debated and laughed and prayed together. Jack had always imagined a home filled with books and love and faith, and he had one. He was raising Joy's two sons as his own. But then the cancer came back. July 13th, 1960, Joy Lewis died. The cancer returned, and this time no miracle. Jack had faced grief before. He lost his mother at 9. He lost friends in the war. He buried his father. This was different. This was Joy, the woman who had awakened something in him, the woman who had become the life he never thought he would ever be able to have. And now she was gone. His heart shattered, and he didn't try to hide it. He didn't dress it up with theology. But he did pick up a pen, and he wrote. The result was this small, raw, brutally honest book called A Grief Observed. And this time, Jack wasn't writing as a professor or as a theologian. He was writing as a broken man. And in those pages, he lashed out at God. He was angry, bitter, and afraid that maybe he'd been wrong to trust God. Where was God now? Why did he have to take Joy? And Jack didn't pretend to have answers. But slowly and painfully over time, what he did find was that in all his grief and his pain, God was still there. And he wasn't upset that Jack was angry. He didn't walk away when Jack had questions. God was still there, present and unmoving. And one day, Jack felt something stir in his spirit, a whisper in his heart that said how wicked it would be to bring the dead back. And then he understood. Joy was not lost. She was safe. And he would see her again someday. And then, that wasn't the end of the revelation, because something much deeper came to him. He realized that the reunion he was longing for right now, and as beautiful and as healing as that would be, to see Joy again, would actually be second to another reunion, to see Jesus face to face. And in that moment, Jack discovered a truth that he actually spent his entire life finding. That the deepest joy is not found in love, books, even Narnia. It's found in Jesus Christ. On November 22, 1963, the world changed. Most people remember that day as the day President John F. Kennedy was assassinated. But across the ocean, in a quiet home in Oxford, England, another life came to an end. C.S. Lewis. He was only 64 years old. There was no big headlines, no breaking news, no camera crews outside his home. His passing was quiet. Everybody was mostly looking at the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. He died the way he lived most of his life, in the background. But his death marked the end of an era. Jack Lewis, known to the world as C.S. Lewis, had journeyed from atheism to belief, from war to peace, from sorrow to joy. He walked through the trenches, through the halls of Oxford and Cambridge, through grief so sharp it almost broke him, and into the arms of grace. He gave the world Narnia, a world where children became kings in winter ends, and where a lion lays his life to save the guilty. He gave the church mere Christianity, a simple, compelling defense of the faith that has drawn countless skeptics towards belief. He gave us the Screwtape Letters of the Great Divorce, the Space Trilogy, and hundreds of essays and talks that still speak today, and many more books. C.S. Lewis gave us a language. He gave voice to doubt, permission to questions, and a vision of faith that was not blind. It was beautiful. He showed us that truth came with a story. He taught us that a good imagination wasn't a distraction from theology. It was part of it. He showed us faith can survive pain. Joy can come after grief. And that a road home begins in the most unexpected places. Maybe a battlefield, a boarding school, or a wardrobe. Jack Lewis, C.S. Lewis, is gone, but his words are still with us, still pointing us, not just toward Narnia, but toward the world beyond it, toward the lion, toward the cross, towards heaven. C.S. Lewis was a rare gift. He wrote words so simple a child could understand it, but his ideas were so deep they stirred a scholar. His books are still read today by casual readers, pastors, theologians, professors. Across denominations, across generations, he offered the world stories that echoed about eternity. In his Narnia series, every character eventually meets Aslan, the great lion, the Christ figure. And when they do, one thing happens. They bow. Some bow in joy and wonder, hearts full of worship, tears in their eyes full of joy. Others bow in fear, realizing too late who he truly is. Lewis was reminding us of a truth straight from Scripture. At the name of Jesus, every knee will bow, and every tongue confess that he is Lord. Every knee, yours, mine, everyone's. And the only question is, how will you bow? Will it be in love as a forgiven child of God, or in fear, facing the justice of a holy king? C.S. Lewis, or Jack, as his friends called him, lived much of his life in doubt. He ran from God. He wrestled with pain. He questioned everything. But in the end, he met Jesus, and he came as a follower with love, joy, and worship. And you too will one day come face to face with Jesus, and you will bow. The question is not if you bow, but how. If you enjoyed today's episode, make sure to subscribe on YouTube or your favorite podcast app so you don't miss an episode. We release new content every Monday. And don't forget to check out our website at lauraleesiemens.com for more information and additional resources. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week as we continue our journey through the incredible history of the church.